You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner Kent. I'm the editor-in-chief of American Theater Magazine. I'm here with the full staff for our year-end episode. I'm here with
Russ Dembin, managing editor.
Deep Tran, associate editor. Wait, senior editor.
Yeah,
I don't even know.
and producer of this podcast, we should note.
And Allison Considine, the staff writer.
Wonderful. I will start off with a little bit of business, just to let you know that our next Off Script will be a live show, January 8th at New York Theater Workshop, as part of our January issue is all about directing, the craft and career of directors, stage directors, and their training. And so we're doing an event January 8th, 6 p.m., New York Theater Workshop here in New York City. We'll have Ann Bogart, Les Waters, Annie Kaufman, Rachel Chavkin, Liesl Tommy, and Jim Nicola, I believe the artistic director of New York Theater Workshop, will also be there to have a great discussion about the director's path. So we hope you can join us, and we'll record that as a podcast if you can't around the country. So I can announce a live podcast. And so today we're going to look back.
Are we Facebook live in this one?
We haven't figured that one out yet. We will record it in some format so that if you're not there, you can hear the great words. Maybe see it. The great work begins. The great words begin. All right. We're going to look back at the year. 2017 was a very eventful, in some ways troubling year for the world, for theater. But we all, we got through it and we're here to talk about it. We'll talk about some of the highlights from the year for us. And then we'll have a conversation with Rachel Dart, who was one of our sources for Deep's magnificent story last week about sexual harassment in the theater. It was called Unmuffling a Culture of Silence. She spoke to more than 100 people who've experienced sexual harassment of some kind.
I spoke to about 40, but we got emails from more than 100 people.
Yes, I spoke to a few myself, but it was a large group of people. Anyway, Rachel Dart has a group called Let Us Work, an advocacy group that's collecting anecdata to advocate for against sexual harassment in the theater. So we'll have that interview with her via Skype later, and then we'll give at the end of the show what we're looking forward to for the year. So let's kick off with the look back at 2017. Allison, I'm turning to you since you're on my right.
I have my handy list here of shows that I saw this past year.
Yeah.
One that jumps out to me is Indecent. I don't think I'm alone in saying that was a highlight for many theater goers. I really love that show. And a week before I had seen it, I was at the Tony Awards and I got to interview Paula Vogel, and she was talking about how she had this experience of seeing Maria Irene Fornes's Fefu and Friends when she was younger, and just had this visceral response where she left the theater crying and in tears. And I was thinking, wow, I've never had that experience before. And then a week later, I saw Indecent and had my Maria Irene Fornes moment.
Wow.
In Paula Vogel's play. So I'm excited to see that is making its round, its way around the country this year. It seems like there's going to be a lot of productions of that. So catch that if you can.
Pick up the play from TCG Books, but go on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or watch it on PBS. On PBS?
I don't know how you watch those things.
I'm not sure if you can go back and see it. My other highlight from this past year, which will come as no surprise to many of you here, was Pride and Prejudice, which I saw at the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival and also at Primary Stages. And it's still running through January 6th at Cherry Lane Theater. Yeah, so it's downtown. And that's Kate Hamill's play, Pride and Prejudice, based on Jane Austen's novel. And it's pretty fantastic if you haven't seen it.
She's on one of our top 10 list and top 20 list.
Yeah, her play, two of her plays are on the top 10 list.
Yes.
Her adaptation of Sense and Sensibility and a new work. Oh, no, Miss Pemberley, that's Jane Austen. That's not Kate Hamill. But she is listed in the top 20. She's number 10 or something.
Yes. Sense and Sensibility.
That's mainly for, although, okay, yeah.
But Pride and Prejudice is making its rounds too already.
But so that's why she's. I think she's on the most produced playwrights list based on several plays. I think. Yeah. And we did a wonderful piece we should plug that you wrote recently about her.
Yes.
Following up in your exhaustive Jane Austen coverage.
Yes.
And
an interview with Kate Hamill, and then tomorrow we'll be publishing a piece on, well, this is Jane Austen coverage, but Miss Bennet, Christmas at Pemberley.
Which is also on the top 10. And it'll be up by the time this podcast is up, I think.
Yes.
That story.
I don't think I ever asked you, are you an Austenite? Or is this just something that we gave to you and now suddenly you're our person?
No, I took a Jane Austen class my senior year of college. And I was not a Jane Austen fan. I had not read or studied her books. And I was in a class full of hardcore Janeites. So that was my introduction to Jane Austen, and I became a fan after that. And I just loved how Kate Hamill and all these other stage adaptations kind of pull the humor that is kind of hidden in the margins of Jane Austen's novels to the forefront. And so I guess I am a self-proclaimed Janeite at this point.
Janeite, yeah.
And thanks to your reporting, some if not all of us have learned about this internal divide. This grand argument between whether the term is Austenite or Janeite.
It is actually Janeite.
Some people are self-identified Austenites, though.
But that's not then they're just not a fan.
They're not real.
Because that's not right.
Okay.
There's the
it's like Trekkies and Trekkers
Society of North America, and they are Janeites. So if you're a real fan, you're a Janeite.
Uh-huh. So I recommend listeners look up Allison's piece from 2 years ago now, two years ago.
Time flies.
About how essentially, sort of jokingly, that Austen's the new Dickens. Like her plays are being, or her books are being adapted all over the country and for the stage. There's musicals of Emma. There's music. A lot of them have turned into musicals. I think I've seen very few titles that have not been. I don't think Persuasion, which is my favorite of her books, has not been adapted for the stage. It's not that stagey. It's sort of,
yeah, it's kind of a meandering tale too.
Well, it's just sort of subdued and subtextual. It doesn't be mm-hmm. Chekhovian maybe, but
well, in due time, because Kate
it's also
Hamill,
not much humor in that one either.
Yeah,
so.
Kate Hamill is set out to do all of them. So
well, I look forward to her Persuasion.
Your Persuasion.
All right. So is that?
I think that's it for me.
All right.
For my roundup of this past year.
Are we talking about favorite things that we've worked on, or is that like another round?
No, we could.
Favorites.
Favorites.
I have a mix of things on stage and then things we've written about and done in the magazine for my year end list. I guess we're going to you now, Deeps. It's your sitting in
the producer's chair.
Counterclockwise fashion. Yeah.
Yeah. We are a fun fact. We have a new podcast setup / mixer thing, and which I just learned how to use. And so I'm learning how to use it as we speak.
It's new equipment. And we might sound better this week. And that's why.
I think we sound better. We're going to be using this for our live events. It's so exciting. So my favorite thing that I saw this year was K-pop, the musical by Jason Kim, a book writer, Jason Kim / playwright. He used to write on Girls, composed by Max Vernon and Helen Park. And I am so sad that it was an off-Broadway musical because the run was so short and it was completely sold out. So not very many people saw it. And we don't know if there's going to be a cast album. And I'm very upset that there might not be a cast album. So it was, I wrote a piece about it for the New York Times, and it is an immersive musical about the making of a K-pop star. Allison and I went, and you as the audience goes through a K-pop factory and you meet like their boy band and their girl band and their solo star, and you get to know these characters and realize that being a K-pop artist is really difficult. It may be more difficult than being a musical theater artist. And it's so rare. I think Rob, you'll appreciate this. It's so rare that musical theater does pop well, because the musical theater tradition, even the songs that are being written now, they sound like they derive from traditions that were established 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure.
And so you rarely ever hear popular music on stage, like popular modern genre music, aside from Hamilton. That's what Hamilton is famous, partially. And this, the genre of K-pop, the musical was K-pop, the genre, which is a very specific genre where it takes American, it's a hodgepodge of American musical stylings like hip-hop, R&B, and pop. Like, they rap in Korean and they perform it in Korean, and it's like, and it's really high, fast pace, very intricate choreography. And the music of K-pop, the musical, it sounded like K-pop songs.
Like the real thing.
Yeah, which is so rare for that to happen. So that made me happy. I saw it twice. It was
Ars Nova, right?
It was Ars Nova and Ma Yi Theater Company.
Do you know if it's going to have a future?
The rumblings I've heard is it has a commercial producer interested.
Okay.
So I hope that it has a future. And it was an all-Asian cast, 14 people, so I hope it has a future so that those actors can do something that's not Miss Saigon.
Or Here Lies Love.
Yeah. I like Here Lies Love. Here Lies Love is controversial, I think,
with some folks,
too.
But that's one I think got pop music right, too. But it's got Fatboy Slim on.
Yeah, exactly.
It is very rare for pop music to sound like pop music in the theater when they say it's supposed to be pop. I mean, it's partly because it's who's doing it. They have musical theater writers who want to tell a story, and they sample the sounds of pop, but they're not really pop writers.
But like, what's musical theater training? I think that's the case too. I think with musical theater training, aren't they trained in a very specific? Well, they derive from that tradition, which is a very specific.
Yeah,
tradition.
I mean, it's just I think that when it's hard to tell a story in pop, and conversely, it's hard to do pop if you're telling a story. So they don't always go together. Hamilton is an interesting hybrid with new sounds in it. And I think Hedwig is another one where I think it's not pop, but that actually sounds like rock and roll. There are very few rock musicals that actually sound like rock. They might sound like prog rock, but that's a different thing. Anyway.
Some consider Les Mis a poperetta.
Yes. I think they'd be wrong. But
yes.
Synthesizers do not make pop to me, but anyway. So Deep, what is it, was that your highlight for the year, basically?
That was the best thing I saw this year.
Okay.
And the highlight for me in terms of writing, you know, talking about Asian, was that thing I wrote about how much I hate Miss Saigon.
Right.
I think it's called I Am Miss Saigon and I Hate It, only because it's like the second most traffic story because Dominic Morisseau beat me. Once again, I was so close. I was number one for a couple weeks.
That story was number one, and then hers got a weird resurgence of interest.
Exactly.
Her piece about almost slapping a fellow theater patron.
Yeah, I feel like we're both very... They're both quite negative pieces.
Oh, I don't know. I think they're both
inequities.
They both have a critical lens, I would say.
Yeah, and people like to be angry.
Speaking
people
truth.
People like it when other people are angry. I think.
I guess that's true. There's anger, but there's also righteous. They're not all negative. I think they point the way to something else. To a better way, to me.
Right.
Anyway, I don't want to step over your year end.
Well, it was one of those things where I don't tend to put myself in a lot of the writings. I mean, I put my opinion in the writings on what I think about things, but like not a lot of people know that, you know, I wasn't born here and this isn't my first language and all of that. And I know a lot about the Vietnam War, but it wasn't what Americans know about the Vietnam War, what I was taught in school. And so taking that and putting it into this musical that people consider to be an accurate quote unquote representation of what Vietnam and Saigon was like in 1975, I think was illuminating for a lot of people because, I mean, there's no Vietnamese people in the creation of that. It was written by white men, white European men.
Right.
And what European men have a very specific recollection of the Vietnam War that was derived from what America put out about the Vietnam War, which is usually very America focused.
Right. It's also filtered through Madame Butterfly.
Which is another problem.
I mean, there's a version
that was great.
You took the debate of beyond the casting controversy, which is like now they cast Asian Americans in the show, but the show still has some issues.
The show so sucks. I mean,
go on.
Yeah, and I also think the reactions I got from that piece were really interesting because I got I knew I was going to get criticized by non-Asian people because that's just who likes Miss Saigon, but I didn't realize I'd get criticized from the Asian performance community and and being criticized for not supporting this thing that employs so many people. And then it made me question, like, why can't I just because some people like it does not mean it's exempt from criticism, which right. I guess goes back mm-hmm. to, like, why do we have critics in the first place?
No, totally.
And so I feel like you can, just because someone criticizes something you love doesn't mean, like, it undermines a thing that you love. Right? Or maybe that's just me as a generally prickly person.
I think it's fair game is what I would say. And anything, you know, I think even the best works deserve to be looked at critically. And I would argue that Miss Saigon, I would agree, is not one of the best works. But also, it's not so much that it's people think of it as accurate. It's just like it's the only representation of Vietnam in popular music. Like, there's no other Vietnam musical. And for that to be the one.
Thank God.
For that to be the one, it's a problem.
And the scholar Stacey Wolfe also speaks to the point of liking things, the ability to like things and still recognize what in those works of art is problematic.
The problematic faves.
Yep.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Indeed.
Well, and isn't there like a thing that says like being really intelligent means you can hold two opposing thoughts in your head at the same time?
I think that's John Kennedy says something like that, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I feel like we're very intelligent people.
No,
that's why we can love and hate something.
It was
something.
A great piece. I think if you haven't read it, give it some traffic. See if we can beat Dominic Morisseau. No.
So close.
So, Russ, how about your year in review?
As far as shows go, among my favorites were Indecent, like Allison, and The Band's Visit, which I got to see in both productions, which was a lot of fun, both at Atlantic and then once it transferred to Broadway. So that was a rewarding experience.
So it was a Katrina length year for you.
It was. Yes. It was.
She stars in both productions.
Yes. Yes.
So go on. So.
Yes. as far as publishing goes, among my favorites were Deep's contributions to the EDI series. I'm very enthusiastic about that series across the board, but Deep's contributions are vital and really critical to the field, and so I want to lift that up. And then in terms of my own writing, it was such a thrill to make a number of visits to Austin, where I lived before I came to work for American Theater and Theater Communications Group, and spent a lot of time with the folks of Rude Mex while they're undergoing a challenging time in their artistic life. And they were moving out of the Off Center in Austin and beginning a period of their life as an itinerant troupe and creating a new work of art at the same time, which was very much informed by that period of change and the various members of the ensemble's reaction to that period of change. And some would say, well, no, it's not about that. We're not in a transition at all. And others would say, okay, but yeah, we are moving out of our space. Yeah, yeah. So it is a transition.
What was it called? Something about a mountain?
Building, yes.
Building a mountain?
Not every mountain.
Not even a mountain, yeah.
Yes, with text by Kirk Glynn and direction by Thomas Graves. They really created the piece together, and it's an outlier as Rude Mex shows go.
Right.
And so it was really cool to see them do something different and how much emotion and feeling they put into that piece. Of course they put plenty into every piece of work they create, but this was a really special one, and it was nice to be there with them for the journey. So that was my piece on building a mountain to scale, we called it in print.
Yeah, it was our cover, July, August, was it?
Cover,
yeah,
the July, August
cover.
Issue. Yep. So there was that, and got to do round two of my ghost beat on Haunted Theaters.
That was
in
fun.
In honor of Halloween. Got to speak with a new crop of folks who have had ghostly encounters at theaters across the country.
Right.
So that's always a blast, and I look forward to year three and talking to some more people who encountered apparitions in the theater.
Great. Well, I don't want to say too many of them. I do have a number of things I want to just briefly go as highlights of the year for me. I too wanted to highlight the EDI series, Deep's contributions, as well as there were other contributions that were in there this year. The Succession story was part of the EDI that Joe Hodge wrote about. That's a big thing. The thing the field's looking at, a bunch of artistic director and managing director positions are opening up or are open. And the question is it going to be more white men, mm-hmm. or is it going to be more diverse field?
That's Joe Hodge, artistic director of the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see. And I do feel like the EDI column was started in April of 2016, but it has taken on more urgency in the age of Trump. It's just, there's just no getting around the fact that one response that we can make to this time of marginalized people under threat and creeping authoritarianism or whatever you want to call it.
And speaking and calling people in power out on their
right. Well, it's
stuff.
Truth to power.
It's exactly. Speaking truth to power. But one of the things I think we do is double down on a commitment to EDI values. That's equity, diversity, and inclusion values internally and externally. Not just the stories we tell. I feel like we spend a lot of time worrying, oh, are we doing the right plays? Are we saying the right things? But also what we're saying with who we invite in the room, who gets to make the work, who gets hired, who's considered for work. So we're going to stay on that topic. And then, of course, the harassment stories that we're in the midst of reporting that Deep wrote beautifully about last week. And we're going to continue to cover that. You know, in a part of that field, we are committed to trying to diversify our own field as well as the field we cover. And so we have our first Rising Leaders of Color critic. I won't go into too much detail. You can look it up on our website. But TCG has a Rising Leaders of Color program where we help mentor young emerging leaders of color. And this year we said, why don't, you know, critics should be leaders as well. Journalists, arts journalists are leaders. And arts journalism is under threat and too white. So TJ Asina is a wonderful writer in Portland who we made our first critic of color as part of this program. He's writing for us as we speak. He'll be writing for us throughout the sort of season. And then in June, we'll pick a new one in St. Louis. I won't go into too much detail there. I would just say on stage, it was a good year for Sondheim. In the spring, the production of Sunday in the Park with George on Broadway finally made that show work for me. And I spoke to Sarna Lapine, the niece of James Lapine. And she had some incredible insights into the show and into James Lapine's part of that musical. Everyone thinks of George as, that's obviously Steve Sondheim expressing himself. She's like, well, actually, my uncle's a lot in that part too. Also,
she directed it.
Yeah, she was. Did I not say that she was the director? She was the director of this production. And then, of course, I think the Pie Shop Sweeney is still running, and that's wonderful. You know, it's maybe not my favorite Sweeney ever, but it's my favorite Sondheim, and it's a great production of it. So,
God, that's good.
It's good. It's good. You know, maybe not as great, but pretty interesting was the Pacific Overtures at Classical Stage Company, which is a very difficult show. It's one of my favorite Sondheim scores. I don't know if that show totally landed it, but we also had Orville Mendoza, a favorite actor of mine, who was in that production and in a production of Pacific Overtures years ago. I saw in LA on a podcast of some months ago, and he actually spoke. He's performed in Miss Saigon as well, so we spoke about his take on that. So tying that,
he agrees with me. So it's all good.
He agrees with you about a lot of it. Yeah, I mean, yeah, he still defends performing in it, but he agrees about the flaws in the show. Certainly,
and hate the performers.
Assassins at City Center made me think quite twice about that show. I've liked it better in the past, but it was a great year to see a bunch of Sondheim shows done by great artists. I think that was it for my year. I tried to rush through all those things. It was an exciting, in some ways dispiriting year in the world, and we had some challenges here at American Theater, and we got through it and put out some great issues, and I have a great staff. So we should go now to our interview with Rachel Dart of Let Us Work, and we will come back after that with some looks forward to 2018 and the future.
Hi, so Rob and I are sitting down over Skype with Rachel Dart of Let Us Work, a New York City advocacy group dedicated to collecting stories from New York City artists who have experienced harassment and using that to advocate with the unions and different theaters for action. Did I sum that up correctly, Rachel?
Yes, you definitely did. Very well summed up.
Yeah, we had Ariel Siebert wrote a piece for us in February, I think it was, of this past year, soon to be over, in which she spoke about it. How long before that had you founded this group?
The survey went out right around the new year for the first time. I had posted on Facebook right after the election, so in November, about wanting to start the project and kind of move it forward. But yeah, the survey went out right around the new year.
So how has it gone this past year? I know obviously we'll talk about what's happened in the last few months and the energy that's created around this kind of reporting and storytelling. But how's it been for almost a year now?
You know, it's been interesting. I mean, I wish that the survey had more responses. I'm incredibly grateful to everybody who has filled it out. It's understandably a little bit of a tough sell, even though it is sort of as anonymous as you want it to be. There's no requirement to put your name or your contact information or anything identifying. But, you know, one of the things that's happened that's been interesting is just that it sort of exists and that I sent out a big sort of email. I posted about it on Facebook and I sent out a big sort of email blast about it right after I created it. And one of the things that happened that in a way I didn't really expect, though it makes sense, is that, you know, people who are on my list of friends and professional colleagues and not just in New York, but all over the country, sent it to a lot of other people. And some of those folks filled out the survey and some of them didn't. But what started to happen is I started to get emails and Facebook messages from people I didn't know who wanted to talk to me. Even if they hadn't filled out the survey or didn't want to, that they wanted to share a story with me, or they wanted to touch base with me about it, or they wanted to say thank you, or they wanted me to help their theater company form a sexual harassment policy. So it really sort of filtered out in a cool way, that I got a lot of messages from people saying, oh, so-and-so forwarded your thing to me, or let me know that you're doing this project. And so I've connected with a lot of people who I didn't know, who have had these experiences and or are interested in sort of shaping change in kind of a great way. So that's been interesting for sure.
And Rachel, I know we talked about this when I was doing my coverage of, you know, sexual harassment, and I called you an expert on the subject.
Hooray!
Well, I mean, because I feel like for me, I collected 100 stories, but you collected 200 stories. And so what were some of the trends you noticed from people who reported, like what kind of people were harassed? What kind of people were predators?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I noticed for sure is that men and women responded in almost equal measure, which was fascinating. Mostly people who respond to the survey are people who have been harassed, though certainly some folks responded who didn't, but who had witnessed it happening to coworkers, which is one of the questions the survey asked, like, have you ever witnessed harassment or assault? So one thing, again, and this, you know, is pretty intuitive, but one thing I noticed is that almost everyone who was harassed or assaulted was harassed or assaulted by someone who was in a position of power. An artistic director, a director, their supervisor, you know, or a stage manager who was harassed or assaulted by, you know, the technical director of a venue or what have you, was almost always somebody who had some kind of power over them. You know, I found I received a lot of stories from people who are who work backstage. I found them to be sort of particularly vulnerable because, you know, for example, and Deepa probably said this to you when we spoke before, but, you know, for example, if you're somebody's dresser and they sexually harass you, there's no one there to witness it at all, you know? And if they're a famous actor and you're the dresser, sort of nobody cares. So those are some of the results that I found kind of interesting and informative. And yeah, certainly people from all ages and people from all across all sections of theater. A lot of these instances happen in an educational setting, which is really sad. You know, teachers with young actors, or, you know, young actors who are in summer stock or who are apprentices or what have you. It seems pretty common also. So, but yeah, I mean, no matter what type of work folks did in theater, they were subject to harassment. You know, I think we hear a lot about this from actors, but it's certainly who are, again, very vulnerable, but it certainly can happen, no matter what your expertise is.
Now, I don't know if you made distinctions, when people would call about the kind of categories or types, because one thing we definitely saw in the stories that came in, I looked at some of them and took some of them as well, was there were definitely different kinds. There was outright sexual harassment we're familiar with, people hitting on people or actually forcing themselves into sexual situations. But there's also gender harassment where it's gender differential treatment for women and men.
Yes.
Some of that is often accused of being perceptual, but there's clear patterns that people demonstrate, especially in this is definitely the case in backstage fields that we talk to folks in costume departments and production departments who they would often be the only woman in the department, and
yep.
they would regularly have to funnel their ideas through male colleagues for the supervisors to listen to, things like that.
Yes.
So did you sort of categorize these or break these out? I mean, we did an informal version of that here, where Deep, you have a spreadsheet of different kinds of harassment, so that.
Yeah, the world's most depressing spreadsheet.
Yes, exactly.
I think you have one too, right?
I do. I have a pretty depressing spreadsheet myself. Yeah. you know, it's a great question. I haven't sort of broken it down into category that way, but certainly there were a lot of people who reported similar kinds of like gender-based harassment of what you're describing. And, you know, again, that when, as you said, Rob, when you're in that situation where you're the only woman in your department, or you're the only woman on the creative team, or what have you, you know, that's already not an environment. And this is something similar they said to Deep, I think, as well. It's already an environment where you're not going to feel comfortable saying that you're uncomfortable. Do you know what I mean? Because part of, I think, sometimes people get nervous when I talk to them about this, because they're saying, oh, well, we're artists and the, you know, we want to be able to continue to be creative and continue to make our art. And sometimes that's an uncomfortable process. And, you know, interestingly, I think the Chicago Theater Standards does a really good job of talking about this. And they say, you know, theater is bawdy, it's profane, it's vulgar, it's challenging. And those are some of the things we love about it. What we're trying to do, you know, the end game of all this is not that we all just like silently scowl at each other and no one can say anything, right? The goal is part of what we want to do is create an environment where when a good faith mistake gets made, you know, I can turn to you and say, hey, please don't say that to me. I don't like that. And that you can say, oh, shoot, I'm sorry. And then not do it anymore. You know what I mean? So like that's a big part of, I think, what we're all trying to accomplish here or at least what I'm trying to accomplish in terms of creating environments at theater companies where that is possible. Because we do want to make room for that. We want to make room for growth and progress, right, in that way. So
right. Well, and for people who – a quick refresher, the Chicago Theater Standards was created by Not Now House, an advocacy group based in Chicago, created by two women who – former actors who – they basically created a code of conduct slash sexual harassment policy for non-equity theaters in Chicago, because those places do not have sexual harassment policies.
Right. And also – and the Chicago Theater Standards also – you know, the women who made it are really been very thorough, and they talk about diversity and inclusion. They talk about actor safety, you know, because a lot of it is specifically to protect non-equity actors, which I think is really important. But yeah, so anyway, all this by way of saying, you know, when you're in a – and I've been in a room where I'm the only woman on the creative team, and someone said something uncomfortable to me, and it was really hard for me to turn to them and say, please don't say that to me. So again, I just think that so much of this, we have to like roll it back a couple of steps and say, okay, you know, how are we doing on parity? How are we doing on diversity and inclusion? Because the better we're doing, the more people are going to feel comfortable speaking up when something happens that makes them feel unsafe or uncomfortable. What message are we sending by programming only plays by and about white men? You know, that's going to maybe suggest consciously or unconsciously to folks that we are not super interested in what people who are not white men have to say about their work environment. Do you know what I mean? So I just think this, you know, so much of what we're talking about is cultural in many ways, which can make it feel daunting, but to me is actually very exciting because it means we can have an approach to it with many sort of different prongs. And that actually makes me feel better in a way.
So I wanted to ask you about the approach. I mean, specifically, I mean, you talk about whether the last few months of reporting and the sort of unleashing of this of the Me Too movement and stuff, whether that's energized you. You can mention, you can touch on that, but I was interested just in, even before that or without that, beyond that, what your goals were with the information you gathered and then the action steps that you're taking with Let Us Work.
Sure. So, you know, part of what the survey is for is information gathering, right? So one of the questions on the survey is, two of the questions are, do we have permission to follow up with you? And also, do we have permission to share your story with names and identifying details removed? And so what that has done has allowed me to, you know, when I speak with people who are, you know, working with equity about these issues, I can give examples. You know, it really is anecdata. You know, I it's tough to crunch numbers in with a survey like this because it's so not a representative sample, right? You know, we're like I said, the vast majority of people who filled it out are people who have experienced harassment or assault. So sorry about that. That was a video on someone else's phone. But it was well timed. I'm just going to like get a soundboard so I can just program screams into wherever I'm talking at the inappropriate moment. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So yes, it allows me to give examples. It allows me to, you know, just be armed with a little bit more information because it's one thing for me to approach places and say, you know, I feel strongly about this. And it's another thing to say, I've had, you know, 8 SDC members approach me and say they've been harassed while working. You know, what can we do about this? One of the things that's happening right now is, you know, I'm starting to work with the League of Independent Theater, and we are trying to figure out a way to for them to be involved in trying to affect some change, especially in indie theater, because, you know, the bar for entry in indie theater is so low. Like anybody can, oh my God, sorry. Anybody can start their own theater company. Anybody can just sort of show up in New York, start their own theater company. And like, there's no qualifications other than being excited about having your own theater company. Right. So part of what Lit does that's so great is they offer a lot of services to those theater companies. So anyway, all this by way of saying it, the survey, part of what it allows me to do with the information is to approach other organizations and say to them what like give them those kind of concrete examples of what people might specifically be needing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's all great. And I don't want to push you too far in this direction, but I'm wondering, again, with the Me Too movement,
yeah.
And basically the difference that has been people naming names, and of course you've heard about the shitty media men list, people sharing privately, but that leading to the actual, you know, firing of some folks. And I wonder, this is a delicate area. It's been a delicate area for us to pursue this as well as any journalist organization, but particularly us, because we're, you know, up in theater's business. And I wondered if that was an area where, when you talk about doing things with organizations, you can't approach them and say, we've had 8 complaints about your theater, or
right.
we this artistic director needs to go and no one should work with him, and so on. Can you talk a little bit about where that area of work, if that's something that has to sort of be compartmentalized or sidelined or private, just speak about that a little bit.
Sure. Oh, I see what you're saying. So how to describe this? So first of all, what's been interesting about the survey is people's unwillingness to name names at all. You know, I would say the vast majority of people who filled it out go to great lengths to make sure that the person who harassed or assaulted them is not identifiable to me. And that continues to be true as people continue to fill it out. One thing I will say has started to happen now, you know, as things have started to kind of gather steam, is that more and more people are approaching me offline and wanting to talk to me about specific people. And saying, you know, oh, well, I had an experience with this person. Do you know anyone else who had an experience with this person? Things like that. And, you know, I'm honoring if, you know, if someone had filled out the survey and had an experience with that person, but had said they did not want to be contacted and then they did not want their story shared, I'm obviously not going to, you know, contact them or share their story. But that's I guess part of what's been starting to change, as you said, right, is that people are starting to sort of feel out if there's anyone else who has had a similar experience that they have had, and sort of trying to not necessarily like approach the press as has been happening so much in Hollywood, but more to sort of like figure out who they might kind of join forces with and just like quietly spread the word and warn people. Because I feel like that's so much of what happens anyway and has been happening sort of all along quietly, is that, you know, long for decades, right? That's how women and men communicate about who is dangerous, you know, is just by sort of the whisper network, right? Through quietly warning each other. But that I think has really been, like I said, really picking up steam recently.
Yeah. I think that one of the things we struggle with, especially in this moment when we're seeing real change happen by people's names being called that and people losing their jobs or stepping down or stepping back or being suspended or whatever, that there's a real sense that that kind of thing will lead to change, not only in those specific cases, but as a sort of chilling effect, much the same way
like
that
accountability.
Well, that
these
that.
People are not so powerful that they cannot be, you know, dethroned.
Exactly. It has, again, not just the specific cases where it's justified and it is accountability, but in much the same way as there used to be a whisper network, against, you know, a maliciousness whisper network against women who reported, right, who would lose their jobs. Things have tilted in the other direction where they should be, where people are starting to talk about, no, that guy, don't work with him. And making the power seems to be on that side of the ledger. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. I think you're totally right. I do think that it's very exciting. I mean, maybe that's not the right word, but maybe it is. It is exciting.
I think,
for a lot of us, especially for women, to see some accountability start to happen, because part of what's so frustrating is, you know, you have a bad experience with someone. Maybe you report it. You know what I mean? Like, that certainly was my experience. Like, my harassment experience was I was sexually harassed. I reported it. And seemingly then not one consequence was experienced by that person. Do you know what I mean? And so then you see them sort of like jaunting around at other theaters and working and doing great and, it's really frustrating. And you know, working with women and young women, and it's just like, it's really, it's frightening. So yes, I think that like that this whole thing about accountability is really, yeah, exciting. Exciting is the word I want to use for sure.
Yeah. I'll share in that excitement. I think it's about time.
Yeah.
So, but you feel like there's changes that can be made on a systemic level, organizationally, institutionally, that can be positive and preventative, short of toppling people who maybe should be or bringing people to account, which
well,
is
that too. But you know, there we should acknowledge that there's also risk with naming powerful people.
Of course,
and,
yeah.
Well, for survivors and naming powerful people, because you never know if there is retribution, if it will actually do anything.
Of course, right. Yeah.
But if it does, that's the first domino.
Yeah, I totally think so. But it doesn't begin and end with ousting all the folks who are perpetrators. I mean, again, very exciting, but there are cultural and systemic changes that could really help, because again, we want to, the goal, right, is to prevent this before it happens. You know, like that's the ideal, is that we can prevent it, right? And it's not always going to be preventable. Predators are predators, and that is just true. But you know, I think again, if you are like again, the Chicago Theater Standards, one of the things they talk about that's so smart is on the first day of any rehearsal, they read aloud the rules. And so imagine that. Imagine working at a theater where on the first day of rehearsal, they say to you, here's our sexual harassment policy. Here's what it looks like. Here's the complaint path. Here's what you do. That would say to you, wow, this is a theater that takes this issue seriously. You know, and that is meaningful, I think. I think it says to people who might otherwise behave inappropriately that they should think twice about behaving inappropriately. And it certainly says to people that, you know, if something happens, they are going to be taken seriously if they decide to report it. So, you know, that's just one small example of sort of a cultural shift. But yeah, I mean, I do think that gender parity, which is not to say that women can't sexually harass people, they certainly can, and have and do. But I do think gender parity is hugely important in terms of this issue. I think that, you know, including more LGBTQ people and, you know, gender nonconforming people, I think that all contributes to an environment where less sexual harassment might occur. Because again, you know, it's about whose voices are we valuing, right? And when you're sending the message that all different kinds of people's voices and experiences are valuable, like that starts to change the culture, right? So I do really believe that parity and inclusion are key in sort of moving things forward with this issue.
Oh, well, we have to wrap up, but the final thing I wanted to ask you was, for people who are not affiliated with institutions, who, and you can answer this either as the perspective of someone who's been harassed or someone who witnessed it, like what can we all do to make a better world industry?
What a great question. I mean, it's such a good question. I would say, certainly for me as a director, you know, my privilege is baked into my position, right? As a director, I cast the folks who are in the room with me. I hire the folks who are in the room with me. And so, you know, for me to think about anyone who's in a position of power in their rehearsal room, right? Whether it's a director, whether it's a stage manager, right? Truly anybody, to say, okay, how am I reaching out to make the people in this room as comfortable as possible? You know, I directed a show over the summer that had a sex scene. And on the first day of rehearsal, I said to everybody, to me, sexual choreography is like fight choreography, and no one's going to do anything they don't feel comfortable doing. And we are really going to score this out in a way that everybody's comfortable with. And that was important to me to say that, because I didn't want anyone to feel sort of any apprehension that they might be put in a situation that they didn't want to be in. So things like that, I think, for sure. I think just keeping an eye out honestly, and not being afraid to take somebody aside and say, hey, that seemed like it might have made you uncomfortable what that other person was doing. Like, how do you feel about that? And even to take aside the person who is being a creep and to say, you know, hey, I think maybe that behavior does not belong in this room. Regardless of whether you're in a position of power in that room, you are capable of saying that. So I don't know. I just think that on sort of an individual level, just those really basic things, taking people seriously when they approach you to tell you that something happened to them, asking the people in your life if those things have happened to them and asking them how they felt about it and listening to their stories. I think all of these things on kind of a one-on-one level are totally, totally possible.
It does seem that the culture change, if rehearsal rooms are, and theaters are run by people who've been through this and have some experience of it or sensitivity to it, as some of us who haven't been through it are being sensitized by this moment, I think that that's one way to tip the culture, because I think it might be possible for women to sexually harass, but statistically it's almost non-existent. And, you know, it's hard to measure progress on this, on that front. And like, is there less sexual harassment? I think one way to measure it would be to look at gender parity numbers, and see how many women are running rehearsal rooms and how many theaters. And,
yeah.
And again, it is kind of anecdata, but I feel like it's, for other reasons, it's worth doing, but this feels like an urgent reason to do it.
Definitely. And I also think too, just for people, as you're saying, right, to sensitize these issues and to sort of, especially for men, I think, to educate themselves about it, because, you know, as much as I have made myself just sort of personally available to the people in my life to talk about these issues, there's some times when I want to say to, you know, my friends or to my family members, let me give you a really great essay to read about this subject. You know, like, I don't really feel like explaining this to you again today. You know, it's a lot of work for you identify with this as someone who's like written this story about this and listened to 100 people tell their stories. It's exhausting. And sometimes it makes me feel very sad. You know, to really sort of, if people can really like do some reading around these subjects and educate themselves, that kind of takes the burden off of the quote unquote experts, and just the non-experts, just the women in their lives to like constantly sort of explain it. Do you know what I mean? I think that sort of like self-educating about the subject is also really, really helpful for everybody.
Yes. And on your part, Rachel, self-care for you.
Yeah.
How can people find out about or be part of your effort? Is letuswork.com?
Sure.
Is that where it is? Or
what's on Facebook? Yeah. We don't have a website because I don't know why, because I'm not good at building websites. But you can find us at facebook.com/letuswork project. And there's all about the project there and a link to the survey. Yeah, those messages are open if people want to contact me directly. So, yeah. Thank
you so much for your work and for talking to us today.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
And we're back with a look forward to, we can do recommendations of shows if you want to do that. But I think the idea is, what are you looking forward to in the field, on the stage, in the world, in the coming year, Russ?
I am looking forward to greater representation of folks from groups we haven't heard or seen from as much in the theater field. And that's broad because it needs to be, because there are a lot of different people we haven't heard from. And based on ethnicity, gender identity, from an access and ability standpoint, I'm really eager to see more women and people of color in leadership positions, more people with disabilities in leadership positions, more of these folks just in the audience and on stages and and on staff at theater organizations, and a greater embrace of universal design, making theater experiences so that anyone of any ability can come into the theater and have just as great a time and just as much of an experience. And I'm also looking forward to us sharing these stories in our pages and on americantheater.org as sources, as subjects, as contributors. And so that's what I'm most excited for in 2018.
Cool. I guess you're next, Deep. Or, you know, I don't want to have the last word. I'll start and then we'll go to you, Deep. All right.
Oh, I'll have the last word.
You can have the last word. How's that sound?
Yeah, I'll take it.
I'll tell you two things I'm looking forward to on stage. Angels in America, the National Theater production, which is coming in February. I look for our March issue all about the return of Angels. I'm looking forward to I'm not really looking forward to Frozen on stage myself that much, but I'm looking forward to taking my kids to it. I don't want to steal your thunder there. And possibly hear the Harry Potter one. I don't know which kid's going to get to see that one if we even get tickets to it.
Well, it's in two parts.
So I guess the little one doesn't especially like Harry Potter. I will say that picking up on Russ's theme a little bit, I am really keeping my eye on gender disparity and gender parity, because the Women's Voices Theater Festival in DC is coming back. Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which has 11 productions each year, has 5 of them by women in the coming season. I won't list them all, but one of them happens to be one of 3 productions that will be up in March and April by Native American women in Oregon on major stages, not small stages. Oregon Shakes doing Manhattan by Mary Catherine Nagel, Delana Studi's, and Then We Walked at Portland Center Stage, and Larissa Fast Horse's Thanksgiving Play, all Native women on stage in Oregon at the same time. I've been tracking we've done this, but this past year I got some volunteers to help me track the gender parity count of playwrights, and it's not ticking up very quickly. But one area that it is ticking up in is in new plays, and I remain encouraged by that. I mean, I feel like it's a long arc. I feel like by the time I retire, maybe we'll have something closer to parity with, I mean, I would hope it's sooner, but I'm taking a long view of at least that aspect of diversity. I think we need more radical approaches, obviously, but I think especially with a sort of canon, like the theater canon, it's going to be slow, but I think it's, the arc is pointing that way to me. So,
and sorry to interrupt. My turn's over, but it is worth mentioning that we, as an organization and as a publication, are also looking forward to greater representation of transgender and genderqueer folks in the mix.
Of course, yes. They often get lumped together with this gender parity, and but yeah, that's its own thing as well. Non-cis male is what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Allison.
This is going to be an echo. I wanted to lift up, earlier this year I wrote about sensory-friendly performances, mm-hmm. that it seems to be a growing trend across regional theaters, that theaters are adapting new practices and learning how to best create shows for children on the spectrum and of differing abilities. So that's been encouraging to see that kind of trickle out throughout the country, that many more theaters are doing that. So I want to lift that up. I also have written down Angels and Frozen. I've never seen Angels, so I'm very excited to see a production of that.
Nice.
And I just got my whole family, so there's like 20 of us. We got a block of tickets and taking all the little cousins to go see Frozen. So that will make it, I think, the experience even better.
I thought you were going to say, we got a block of tickets to go see Angels in America.
Well, you know what? That would be a good idea, too. That might be more...
that might be more educational.
Educational
for them.
Sure. For the family. It's Deep. Go ahead.
Okay. It's my turn again? Okay, it's my second turn. What I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to next year's Humana Festival, only because I don't make friends with a lot of theater people, even though I'll have a lot of them on Facebook and Twitter, because I feel like I'm an old school journalist and I try not to be friends with the people I cover. Except for one person, Leanne and Anaka Winkler, because we went through the Mikado controversy together. And so I feel like when you go through something like that, you just have a bond.
Yeah.
And she defended me against some trolls on Facebook. So I felt like we should be friends after that.
And she has a play at Humana.
She has a play called God Says This, which is based a little bit on her own life. It's set in Kentucky, about with a half Japanese family, and the mom has cancer. And it's a sequel to her play Kentucky, which ran at Ensemble Studio Theater and at East West Players last year. So I'm looking forward to paying my own way, because I know it's not my turn to go to Humana in 2018. So I will pay my own way to go to Humana.
She's really on the rise. I mean, she's got a couple different prizes. We just posted one this week.
25
for Jerome.
Yeah, the Jerome, the 40K Jerome, and the $25,000 something Playwrights Horizons.
Oh, no, and then with the Mark O'Donnell.
Yeah,
the Mark O'Donnell one.
Yeah.
Which was meaningful because I knew Mark O'Donnell a little bit. It's fascinating. Anyway, props for that.
And can I talk about something a little darker?
Oh, please.
Which is the organization has been looking into sexual harassment allegations, mm-hmm. and I know a few other journalists who are also looking into it in the theater industry, and so I'm looking forward to the conversation that will ensue when some big names in the industry start dropping. Because I think a lot of people are waiting for that. And so
There's definitely been a question about why there haven't been more names in the theater named. And we'll be part of that conversation somehow.
Yeah. Sorry.
There's no question about that.
We will.
We're on the case.
We're on it.
Well, I think with that, we close with wishing you all a safe and happy holiday season, however you spend it, and with whoever you spend it. Maybe see a show, or take a break from shows, or break a leg in a show. Watch out for ghosts, and we'll see you next year.